But you have to be that conduit between what you think they want versus what the guy actually swinging the hammer, using the tools, working the tools, ends up putting in place and setting in those expectations.
Hello, construction industry professionals. You're listening to The Art of Construction, specifically designed for contractors and architects to help grow your business. Here are your hosts, Devin and Kevin.
As we always say, we make these shows global and timeless, and we're always talking about Denver, Colorado. But today, we're going to jump over to the other side and get Connor Fox, who's a project manager out of Rutherford, New Jersey, who his company does a lot of projects in New York. So I thought it'd be fun to have a different perspective. He's a personal friend of mine. Come into Studio MVD and talk about his projects that he's working on in New York.
No, I'm absolutely excited to hear about Connor's projects. And he works for an amazing company, L&K Partners, in New Jersey. And they do a lot of work in Manhattan in a very tough environment. So really interested to hear his perspective on how they manage projects for big clients in a big city.
So let's dive in and have a chat with Connor Fox of L&K Partners. And always, I'm Devin Tilley, president owner of Mountain View Window and Door.
And I'm Kevin Keefe, chief relationship officer and sales consultant for Mountain View Window and Doors. Here we go.
What's your favorite beverage?
Beer.
And tell us about what beer from Colorado just hit New Jersey.
Fat Tire, and the entire state is very excited.
They can't stop talking about Fat Tire. That, to us, is old news.
They actually printed new labels that say, finally in the Garden State, on the label of the bottle.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice. What's a favorite place you've traveled?
I put Colorado up there, but I typically go to Florida just so I don't have to do anything for a few weeks. And that's probably the best thing to do is nothing.
There you go. Yeah. So what's a favorite hobby, interest, what you like to do when you're not in the construction field?
Unfortunately, as you guys know, in the construction field, it never leaves. So you're always doing it at your house. There's no hobby. It's always replacing something, fixing something. There's never a non-construction day when you own your own home.
But you have passions outside of construction, right?
Listen and collect vinyl records still.
Yeah. Really? Nice.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping you were going to say. When I met Connor at a wedding, and then I was like, oh, we got to go see this guy. And I scheduled a trip out to his place in Jersey. What's the town?
Rutherford, New Jersey.
Rutherford.
Yep.
We get there, and this was pre-kids, which it's a lot different world now. So it was Sarah and I flew in there. We go out, and we're like, we're just going to kick back in Rutherford, New Jersey. I've never been. I'm from Fargo, North Dakota. It's a different world. They just set up this awesome dinner, and he brings out the record player. And I was just like, what? And the whole night was this education. And tell us about why you listen to vinyl and your music and your tastes and that whole thing.
Well, we talk music, as you know, a soundtrack of life. We talk about it. It sounds better. You have more intimate feeling with the music. It's not just plugging the digital. Unfortunately, we're doing digital. We're plugging in digital music and you don't really feel it. But when you put on a record and you kind of get that groove and you hear it coming through those speakers, how it sounded 40 years ago, and even down to the smell of opening up the LP, and you're like, wow, it's an experience. It's not background music at a mall anymore.
Yeah, so he collects records, like his whole basement's just full of records, you know. And so we were pulling out all these old school
Sam
records.
Cooke.
Yeah, it's just nice. As the beers kept flowing and the records kept going, it's like going back in time. It was cool stuff. So that was kind of the weekend when I really became friends with Connor. And his day job is we're both in the construction field. And like he said, it's if you have the passion for it, we're always talking about projects and this and that. And the real reason, this is kind of the secondary thing to get him into Studio MVWD, but back in music conversation is, what are we doing tonight, Connor?
We're going to see Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band.
This is going to be a fun weekend. We actually personally met him on a couple's retreat to a resort where his wife went to college with my wife, and we went to Steamboat and had a weekend of skiing. And so that's what's cool about working in the passion and the construction, all of us coming together. What we want to talk about today is peel back the layers on project management. And there's so many different learning lessons in this out there, but I feel like a lot of the time where the rubber meets the road, you miss that story as far as educating. And there's a lot of unsung heroes on a project. And that project manager is really that go-between on all the different layers. So that's why I wanted to have him in here and kind of talk through on the New Jersey side here in Denver, Colorado, maybe things done a little bit different, and maybe we can cross-pollinate and talk through that kind of stuff. So sure. Tell us about who you work for and what you do on a day-to-day basis, Connor.
I work for a mid-size general contractor, construction manager in New York City. We do about $250 million a year in work, which doesn't sound like a lot, but there's bigger firms than us in New York. So we're a small shop, as we call it. There's 40 to 50 people in our shop. We hire and have employed anywhere from teachers to architects to former engineers and to that. So to go to your point, anybody really with that skill set can kind of develop and evolve into becoming a project manager. And to go back to what we do, in New York City, you either build the building, the shell, and the floors, and you kind of walk away and you say, all right, if you build it, they will come. Somebody will come in, they'll take a floor. Now I hire a new architect, a new engineer, a new firm entirely, and they would come and build the insides. We build the insides because a lot of times, like you said, half of New York is new. The other half is 300 years old. So there's unique challenges in both regards. We're fortunate to kind of deal with both across the board, whether it be residential, commercial. We do banks. We do restaurants. We do five-star restaurants. We've done five hotels in the last 3 years. Runs the gamut. Yeah, that's a little what L&K Partners does.
Cool. So tell us about the project you're working on right now.
It's a social media company that we're all familiar with, which I can't share the name. We were building their New York headquarters downtown. They are slowly taking over the building. We're doing about 80,000 square feet. It's an interesting product because, as you know, it's a more youthful kind of company, and they really cater to people being there all the time. You know, in our day, you kind of took that hour lunch and you went away and you hid in the corner somewhere, or you hid it at a sandwich shop. They don't want people to leave. And it's an interesting place because they spend a lot of money to make it look like it was always there. It's been there for 20 years, which is an interesting feel. So you kind of got to capture what they have. A very precise architect out in the West Coast, which you'd all know if I could, but I can't, so I won't.
Well, that sounds like a fun project. So, Kevin, wouldn't you say as a window and door supplier in your day-to-day career, the project manager can make or break a project that you've put all the time to get it right on paper? If they really care and understand or know what they're doing versus the opposite side, doesn't that really dictate how a project goes? And how do you think? What do you think of project managers?
Well, I think it's critical. First of all, to answer the first part of the question, it does make a huge difference because it's all about organization. It's about communication, cooperation, and getting the job done in a timely manner. And if somebody's organized and dialed in and can communicate well, there's great results. If the opposite happens, it's not too fun for anybody on one end or the other. And it really does make a huge difference. It absolutely does.
So, Connor, what's the key to a successful project management?
Well, I think you teed off on it right there. I mean, it's my role. And again, I was never accredited as a PE, or I was never in the trenches for a long period of time. I was supposed to be an English teacher. I think the key to that is communication. And I think drilling down to the issue at hand, because you're dealing with clients a lot of times. Our motto is, you give me any material, I can build anything. But a lot of times the client doesn't know as much about the industry as they should or shouldn't. It's not their job. They're going to move in 6 months and the job should be done, and you walk away and hopefully they're happy. But you have to be that conduit between what you think they want versus what the guy actually swinging the hammer, using the tools, working the tools, ends up putting in place and setting in those expectations. Because if you don't communicate that, they're going to show up at the end of the job and you're just going to be redoing it, because however that didn't get translated is really part of the communication, as you just said.
No, absolutely. It's critical.
Yeah.
What are some key things that you see out there that help with that communication?
I think the biggest thing, and it really, as you guys already know, is windows and doors. You're a piece to the global piece of the job. There's lights, there's flooring, there's all this other material. There's millwork, there's counters, there's stone, and really getting down to the truth. Because so many times you meet with these subs, and we're good to go, and then you go, well, when did you release those lights? Well, I didn't yet. And then you just look back and you're like, oh my God, we're screwed. And then you're scrambling around. So you're really getting down to the core issue of getting materials released, getting a transparent facts from not just from the subs, but from the distributors. And from, so all of that comes together, build that job in that order. We just can't have doors show up and, well, I don't have any walls up because the stone guy didn't get released and the lighting didn't get done. So it is a dance, and it's a very unique dance. But getting to the bottom of the job and really, it starts there. You build the job from the ground up. And then at the end of the day, it all comes together, scaringly, most of the time. So,
from my experience as a builder, what I always try to do is to encourage everybody to leave the egos at the door. Yep. And be truthful. I mean, if there's a problem, let's know it now. Don't tell me the problem 6 months from now. Tell it to me now so we can find a solution collectively. And then when everybody is willing to do that, works a lot smoother.
And you can actually, as a client would know, you can go to that client 2 months before the job's done. Listen, I'm having an issue with lights. You want to either pick something else or do you want to wait? And that is out early. I just had a job yesterday. We're finishing. The job is being finished on Monday. The millworker told me I don't have enough material. Well, I lost that opportunity to relay it to the client. Now they're all mad at me because we don't. It's not just I can throw them under the bus. We all fail together. You all succeed together and you fail together. There's no longer like, well, it was his fault. Well, he works for you. It's all about managing the expectations of what your client thinks at the end of the day is going to be done.
So tell us about the most unique construction project that you've done.
Well, recently, funny that we're going to see Bruce Springsteen tonight, I had an opportunity to clean up a mess from a general contractor that was doing Steve Van Zandt, who's Little Stevie, who's a guitar player for Bruce. Smaller shop was doing his studio's executive bathroom and shower, and he didn't do a very good job. And we had to come in and really pick up the pieces, literally, from material he had left in a closet and tools he left behind and match and figure everything out, which is very interesting because imagine trying to put 10 people in a room the size of this room, which is... a shower and a bathroom, and trying to finish it within 2 weeks. And he kept changing his mind, which is more interesting because he likes black and white checkers and purple, a lot of purple. So that was interesting. And then having him come in and tell me I need to paint everything purple again. That was unique in its sense just because the smaller ones are usually the harder ones. I mean, as you guys know, on these bigger jobs, you can kind of hide people and, something doesn't go your way and something doesn't happen, you can hide them in a corner. But with these little jobs, if you don't get the stone down on Monday, you're not doing the plumbing on Tuesday, and you're not getting the water running on Thursday, there's nowhere to go. There's nothing to do. So I find the small ones are actually more challenging and more unique in that regard because it is a living job day by day. Like I said, the big ones you can kind of hide and restructure as the week goes on, but not these little ones. That's the crazy part.
So that's a huge spread that your company takes on. So you yourself manage, you said, an 80,000 square foot tenant finish and a rock star's bathroom.
Yeah, and we do it all the time. My company, like I said, we're mid-sized. We started off just doing conference rooms. In 1997, doing $20 million a year, which isn't a lot in New York City. Now doing $250 million a year. And the jobs just get bigger and bigger, and they get faster and faster. And, we do a lot of high-end. We do a lot of work with Tiffany's in New York City, from their offices to their stores. So that is a unique challenge, just because they are expecting the best of the best. We have a reputation. Like I said, we're not all builders, and we're not all, but we understand what the client wants. And we're all hands-on. And they understand you can pick up the phone and get the PM or the owner of the company down there at any given time. Whereas since you have these larger companies, you kind of had to go through the channels and you're dealing with so many people. And L&K is not like that at all. We're, like I said, we call it small mom and pop. We are hands-on, small shop who actually has the client's needs kind of at the best interest.
What kind of issues do you run into being in a major metropolitan environment like New York City, high-rises, et cetera, where you got to deal with getting materials up to the 60th floor or whatever it may be, and you've got freight elevators that maybe don't work or you can't get access to, or to talk a little bit about how you coordinate and deal with those kinds of things?
What's funny is the buildings have their own personality. Every building, from the Empire State Building to a building downtown, they all have their own personality because different personalities run them. So different guys who run the loading docks have different needs. They need a cup of coffee. They need their ego stroked. But at the end of the day, getting with them, getting on the good side, following the rules, which is important, understanding that it's their house. And at the end of the day, you're leaving in a set period of time, whereas they got to be there and you kind of leave their building the way it is. If you don't follow the rules, they make the job extremely difficult. Your truck won't be able to deliver. Your material or your manpower won't be able to get up to the job. So every building is a little different because every person's a little different. Which is always a little, you got to feel them out. And that's the first thing you do. The first thing, you go meet with that building and you meet with the engineers who are there. You go meet with the loading dock. You look them in the eye. What do you need from me? And that is the key to coordinating in New York City. Getting things to the building is extremely difficult because of where it is. And there's just so much activity going on in the city right now. It's crazy, the amount of work.
Now, do you ever run into situations where you're working in an older building, maybe where the freight elevators don't accommodate the size of equipment that you need to get up there?
Oh, absolutely. We've done jobs where we've actually had to pop the hatch, take the roof off the elevator, and load the glass on top of the cab because the glass was so large that it would not fit in a 24-foot freight elevator. So we literally had to take the top off and put it on top like John McClane climbing in Die Hard. So, yeah, it happens all the time. And a lot of times, the design of the space, you'll tell the architect, no, you can't design a 20-foot piece of millwork because it clearly just won't fit. So, sorry, do something smaller. And they get all mad at you, and then they go and measure, and then they realize, yeah, you're right. Okay. So it does drive a lot. Small stuff like that does drive the end game and the product.
That's so wild. When you're given a project, the first thing you do is go try to understand the culture and what that building is all about and the people that are both involved of the front end of designing it, but also people working there, because you want to make friends with the people that are there while you're working, right?
Correct, because there's a little, you know, there is some companies that have left some sour taste in people's mouth. They get a bad reputation, but, you know, fortunately, we tend to do the right thing. And like as we said, at the end of the day, In 4, 5, 6 months, I'm leaving. They live there. They're there for the next 2 years. I gotta leave it the way I found it. And as I'm done, the client has to move in. And you don't want to leave that sour feeling towards the client who's now occupying this floor for 10 years. They annoyed us for the 6 months and really made it really hard on us while we were building this building. So it trickles down. It really does.
Tell us how your company works as far as, are you involved at all on the sales side, or is it totally done and they say, Connor, here's the project, we've been awarded it, and how does the handoff go from kind of sales to logistics of what we would call it here at Mountain View?
Well, believe it or not, the teams, and you say your teams, you typically you'd have the principal in charge, which would be, you'd have this project manager, whoever it would be, your super, and your field office people in the interview with the client, believe it or not, before the job is even awarded. They ask, who's my team who's going to build this job? So you'll go in with ABC company who wants to do 3 floors of the World Trade Center, and they really feel your personality. This is my team. This isn't a bait and switch. You know, Mike's going to build this office, and you'll see him here every day. And you sit across from the client every day, and they look at you, and they say, okay, I like this guy, or they don't. So we're involved early on before the job's even awarded, which goes, we talk about my company, 90% of our work is repeat clients. So we're doing something right. It's either word of mouth. We work with consistent architects. We work with consistent engineers, and they say, hey, this is perfect for a type of company, L&K. They're not super huge. You're going to get all their attention. So we have that reputation, which goes a long way in the city, because there's so many people now that want to be coddled a little more. They want their hand held through the process. Wasn't the case for a long time. So it's important to see our face at the interview to the day we hand over their user manuals and say, here's your space. Call me when you need me. We'll be here anytime something goes wrong.
How do you work in an environment like Tiffany's? I'm imagining, like, not so much their office space, but when you're talking about the retail space, are you working after hours? Or are you working during the period of time when the store's open? And how do you coordinate all that?
It's always after hours. For instance, and it's not just Tiffany's in that regard. These places, they cannot afford to be closed. They'll never close. So we would come in. Obviously, it adds to the cost. We come in logistically and always adds to the schedule, but they don't care. You work from 8 o'clock at night to 5 in the morning because then they have to get their store or whatever. It's not just Tiffany's, but it's other stores, like even a bank. Believe it or not, there's been some times if you stay in the building too long, you get locked in and you were sleeping the night on the floor because it is that sensitive place where there's, you know, merchandise on the floor and sorry. You're here to the long haul. See you at 7 a.m. in the morning. So it is tricky. It is a sensitive area. And again, it's all over the city.
So working in that environment, then you have to have kind of a procedure as far as closing up and closing down to where whatever mess you're making, you have to time it to be done to where whatever that business is operating the next day, or at least board it off,
correct,
up and look presentable.
We actually have to tell them in a lot of cases, they call it in the MOPS, method of procedure. You give them almost a Bible of what you're going to do step by step. I'm going to open the door at 7:01. I'm going to lay protection on the floor at 7:02 from 8 o'clock. I'm then going to paint the wall from 8:01 to 9. It's down to the little details. We've done jobs in certain retails that there's an armed guard standing next to my tradesmen, off-duty police officers, just because that's the way it is. Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting environment. It's never boring. It's never dull.
Now, do you guys ever work outside of New York City or New York State? I mean, I'm thinking as an example, again, of Tiffany's. I mean, you're doing repeat business for them and they want you to go work in Beverly Hills. Are you guys able and willing to do that, or do you pretty much stay on the East Coast?
We stay on the East Coast. We are in New Jersey because Jersey City follows New York City. If you've ever been to Jersey City, it's literally across the river and it kind of follows suit. It's the little brother that kind of follows the big brother to the ball field. As New York goes, Jersey City goes, and it trickles down. It's usually about a year behind in the activity. We've done work South Jersey, but it's really the relationships we build are with the trades, and you get the better product and you get the better cost for the client at the end of the day. because you know those subs. If right. you take that risk and you go to Connecticut or you go to Pennsylvania, they don't know who you are, and they're not going to give you the best buy. They're not going to give you the deal because they know they might not ever work with you again. But as long as we stay in our little world of New York, New Jersey, we continue those relationships. You can call up any plumber, any carpenter. I need 10 guys here tomorrow, and they'll be there. So that's the relationships we tend to build.
Yeah, and we're always talking about that on The Art of Construction is do a few things really well yep. and really own your category. And I would say New York's a pretty – that's a big little spot.
It's a big little spot. And like I said, you know, we get comfortable with certain buildings. And I just did a job recently. It was 500-square-foot conference room for their leasing department. And they give us a tryout to do the work in their building, which is a landmark building in New York City. You had to put the right team in there to not disappoint. If we screwed it up, we're not getting any more work in that building, which is – up and down the city. You know, you get that opportunity, you get that one opportunity, and if you don't do it right, you may never get it again. That goes a long way as far as our company, like I said, putting the right people in place, putting the right team in place, and making it successful.
So correct me if I'm wrong, you've been a project manager in other areas of the country as well, like Florida, correct?
It's in Florida.
So tell us the difference about working in New York versus Florida and how things are different and things you learned as being a project manager in very different markets.
Florida was interesting. In Florida, because it's a free trade state, so there's no unions. I'm not sure. Does Colorado have unions? I'm not sure. So you're free trade state.
Yeah, for the most part.
For the most part. Yeah. So I came from New Jersey, which was a primarily union work, to go down to Florida, and it wasn't so much less quality. It was just kind of the less control that a lot of these PMs had, because if you're not in a union and they're, you know, if you don't do your job, there's repercussions. A lot of times in Florida at 2 o'clock, the guys want to go fishing because it was a nice Friday and they want to go fishing. And I think the thing in New Jersey, when I moved down there, the New Jersey kind of attitude or mentality, whatever you want to call it, worked, because I was like, no, I'll just get somebody else to do it. And they appreciated it. The client appreciated it. It is laid back. It's a slower world, and it's, you might as well add a month on every schedule down in Florida, especially the South. You know, they're not as quick to go. Whereas in Manhattan and New Jersey, they expect things done almost at a ridiculous schedule. I mean, things, just because you did it one time, you finished something in a 2-week period, now that's the norm. They expect that, which is just unfair, because you produced a door or a window and then because it was an emergency. Well, now everybody expects, Mountain View can crank out 20 doors in a week. Yeah. Well, that was a favor.
Yeah, it's the people that the 911 is every time.
Every time. And that's the problem with our industry, especially up north, is everybody thinks the norm is the 911. And you did it once, and it's scary how everybody expects it. Because like we talk about materials. Materials drive the job. You can throw a million guys in a job, but if I can't get what I need to build the job, I'm not building it. If I can't get the material, I can't get the product, I can't get the flooring, there's just no way of making schedule. And that's key.
You mean if the guys are there to put the flooring in, they don't have flooring?
No, unbelievable, right? Crazy thoughts. I can't get you what I don't have, you know? So that's – we talked about it before. I mean, so many times everybody just flat out lies to you, especially in our industry. They just flat out, yes, I'll have that. And then when the time comes, I gave it to somebody else. It's amazing if getting down to when things are actually showing up or when people are really going to be there to do what they say. It's really bad in glass, by the way, just so you guys know. Really bad in glass, especially the higher-end glass.
But the people that do the things they say they're going to do, are those the ones you call first next time?
Yeah, every time.
I mean, it sounds simple, and it's kind of like you shouldn't have to say that, but it's like the people that treat people they want to be treated. And if you screw up, tell them.
Yeah.
And so at least you can make a plan. But making up a story, to me, just doesn't work long-term. Well, but it sounds like that's – part of the norm for you.
I learned a long time ago, and an old coworker of mine, he told me, I was young PM coming through, and he goes, I was trying to fumble my way through the truth, and he said, rule number one, don't make shit up.
Quit making shit up.
Stop making shit up. That's that. He goes, you'll never have a problem with a client or a job if you just tell what the issue is and come to the table with, here's how I'm going to solve it. Yes, I don't have this, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you this, and it might be a week late, but it will be done. And they say, okay, you didn't just tell me the problem. You came with me with a solution. Again, we talk about it. It's communication. Like I said, I was supposed to be a teacher. If you have the ability to work with people and understand where they're going and what they're thinking, you can do this. It's not that hard. It's really not.
Well, to me, so much about construction has to do with solving problems, anticipating problems, and then finding solutions to those problems. And you can't do that if you're all making shit up.
Yeah,
it's
no,
just the bottom line. I mean, I've been on all sides of this equation, and it's just the common denominator is if you do what you're talking about and you get good information, then you can make good decisions and have good outcomes. But when things are all mixed up, like a deck of cards thrown all over the place, you don't know where to even pick up.
Or the worst is when people try to hide things. When you're trying to hide the fact that you're not getting it done, and then the last minute you're trying to spring it on, and you have no chance of saving any face or getting another job with that client. Don't hide anything. The sooner it comes out that there's an issue, like you said, solve the problem. Okay. And most of the time, people are reasonable, which is refreshing in some cases, but not always.
So on the flip side of the most unique, what's the most challenging project that you've done? And tell us a good New Jersey story here, New York story.
Well, I had a glass guy. He had a supplier come from England, and he promised me he'd be there, I think, the first of the month. And, of course, it didn't show for another month, and the client missed their move-in day. And ultimately scrambling around and just getting an alternate product. It's reaction. It's reaction in the city. It really is. Knowing you got lied to and it didn't show up. And so now what do you do? That is the biggest challenge, reacting to being let down, because you are let down all the time. And knowing the fact that you're never going to use that guy again.
So that glass guy, you actually, he didn't not even got the sale in the end, right? He went somewhere else?
Oh, no. I took all his money and I paid somebody else with it. He got a deposit. That's the hardest part is... You never want to be a bad guy, and you pay these guys up front, and you pay them to get things done, and they just let you down, and you never want to hurt anybody financially, because that's not the end of the game. There's so many other GCs in the city that just look to screw the little guy and make money on their backs and get the job done and ultimately trying to get over on them. It doesn't work anymore. Those days are gone of being bullies to the subs. I believe that. That's my way. I mean, everybody has their own kind of style of how to get blood out of the rock, yelling and screaming at people and saying, just get it done. Those days are gone. Because in our market, because the trades have so much power, they hold all the cards. You know, they're the ones ultimately will get it done. So screaming at them, yelling at them up front, it doesn't really get it done. You gotta acknowledge and identify that sub's going to let you down. All right, I'm sorry. We'll work on the next job together, but you're done. So in that case, I had to not use him, and it was nothing personal. I had to bring in another guy. I lost a month in the schedule, and nothing for nothing. 6 months later, I went back to the original glass guy on another project, and we laughed about it and had a beer. It's just nothing personal, but ultimately, you just have to get the job done.
And that's a good attitude about it. Yeah. But us as a supplier on a window and doors on our day-to-day job, the customers or contractors or project managers that are not always a 911 and they truly want to work with you, but if something really needs to get done, once you have that relationship, you get it done.
Yeah.
It's the people, the project managers that drive me nuts is it's always screaming and yelling and they always need it yesterday and it's always a problem. I look at them as you need to look yourself in the mirror. If you're always screaming and yelling, maybe you're doing something wrong. And they're the first ones we want to fire. And when times are good, I think that's what you're saying is it's busy. It's just like that in Denver. We actually had a meeting this morning and we were looking at all of our pipeline and our pie charts and all this stuff. And we were looking at which customers we're going to fire, which ones are the biggest pain in the asses. And that's the real scenario. And I think that's what you're alluding to, right? You've been very successful because you take the time to have that relationship and don't abuse that.
No, we don't. And that's key to it's amazing from the job to job. And every 6 months it's a different project, but you see the same faces across the table. And I think to your point is the first meeting you have with everybody around the table, like, what do you need to finish this job? What do you need from me? What do you need from the architect? Because we always talk about it. A good super makes a good PM. A good laborer makes a good super. A good super makes a good PM. A good PM makes a successful project. And the subs are the same way. You try to avoid getting a dog on the job. You do, but it happens. You get them. But you look across the table and you say, all right, guys, what do we need to get this going? And now's the time. You don't get another opportunity. Now's the time to say we can't or we can. And you're right. That's identifying that early is really and those guys who continue to come through, you keep using them. And that's the world. Like, why go to, you know.
And you'd actually pay the guy that's really good. He's earned it. You'd pay him a little bit more than the guy you don't know or trust.
It's common all the time. For instance, on many jobs, you say, well, I'll pay that premium to have that tradesman down, even down to that foreman. But that sub, whoever it be, electrician or mill worker, I'll pay an extra 10 grand to make sure he's on the job because I know he'll get it done.
Yeah. And so contractors and architects listening to this, Grant's one of our heroes here at Mountain View Window and Door, and everyone requests, I want Grant on my job. Everybody wants Grant. And that's key to be able to get people on your team that are that way because now as the owner of Mountain View, we have a luxury of people that are literally calling and requesting that person But you also have to be smart about that. How can you clone that or put systems and structure in place so you're not pigeonholed to one person either?
Well, that's true because, like, as you mentioned, we deal multiple jobs with the same client. So you can't have the same two guys run all their jobs because they're not all going on at one time. So that you could have three XYZ company going on at the same time. So you got to show your diversity in your company. You can't just have one superstar and the rest kind of just, yeah, he's all right. So as a company, you identify those teams early on. For instance, I work a lot with one super because we understand each other. We get it. We know what the client wants. It's you don't have to retrain and rethink everything, but you got to have those teams. You got to have that diversity. The other team is a totally different type of project, but they got to have the same mentality. And that really trickles down from the top of your company. What do you believe in? And it's where we're strong in our because we are a small company. Our owners are hands on. That's where it starts.
So being a project manager in multiple different companies, you don't have to go into the details of how you're exactly paid. But my question would be is how did you see different companies or contractors get the reward? Or was it a one bonus at the end or different systems and structures that were one was more successful than others?
No, we typically don't do bonus programs. I mean, the job is set from the day you sign the contract and you are given your schedule. Everything is very clear. Here's your schedule. Here's what you're going to make. You try to avoid change orders because nobody likes them, even me. Even though I have to write them, and sometimes it makes you more money for your company, but you try not to do that. But typically, there's no bonus structure trickle down through to the trades. You know, seldom do you see even the general contractor in commercial construction. When you do the building, I've seen a lot of times. My old company, if you finish the building on time, you got a bonus because usually there's liquidated damages. So you can't just have a bonus. You got to have a penalty too. So if you miss that day,
it's going
the other way. So you can't have one without the other. You can't just say to you, if you're not done by May 1, I'm going to start hitting you every day $10,000 a day. Well, that's not fair. If I finish early, doesn't the same go true for a bonus? And it's true. Usually that works in the core and shell buildings where you're putting 40 stories up. Not really in the industry of interior buildouts.
Gotcha.
They try because, again, the day they're not open, the day they're losing money.
So what are some new construction trends or things that you're seeing in New York of over the years, stuff that's going on, cool stuff?
A lot of people are going green. We talk about going green. You see a lot less like flooring material. You're seeing a lot more polished concrete. You're seeing a boatload of LED lights. You're seeing all this cool harvesting for the light harvesting for the as sun comes up and goes down, which is difficult because they're tying it into their window shades. And it's kind of all this unique dance of everybody tries to go green, but no, until they see the dollar amount, because it's really expensive to go LEED.
Yeah.
It's really expensive. No one wants to pay for it. It's a great theory in the world of construction, but when the client, oh my God, I got to pay 30% more because I want to have recycled flooring. No, I'll just go with the stuff that's, you know, terrible for you. But you see a lot less offices being built. You see a lot more open collaborative spaces. So that changes the construction. You're not just building walls anymore. You're usually glass partitions. So you're feeling like you're a part of the floor. Like, you know, the bosses aren't sitting in the back corner office hiding from the world. They're out front. It's either a shared office. It's a shared workspace. So you book a room, that's your room. You see a lot more amenities for they don't want you leaving. They want you staying in the space. So they're hiring a barista to come sit there and make you coffee any way you want it, free of charge. They're sitting there, there's lunch free of charge. They kind of have these breakout areas and lounges. So you stay there and you work as a team and you're not just kind of going out and hiding. You see, so that trickles down to what you're building. You're not building drywall partitions anymore. There's no more drop ceilings for say. It's really open lighting, natural, which believe it or not, is not cheaper. To finish concrete, to finish a ceiling that's an exposed beam from 150 years ago, paint a steel girder beam to be fireproof, but it looks like the original beam when they placed it there 20 years ago, that's not cheap, but it looks really cool. Yeah. So that's the trend.
Yeah, so a lot of parallels for us here in Colorado is that whole indoor-outdoor living space and high walls, all that stuff, but they're creating it in high rises, creating these big open spaces. Like you see, there's a movie, Robert De Niro is like, he was the intern. Called The Intern.
Yeah.
I thought that was really like fitting as far as, but it's still, there's a lot of things to take away from that. The old school, be nice to people, not get overwhelmed. But yet, I've been reading a lot of articles about Amazon and all these companies.
It's amazing.
About how they're creating these environments to
Well, that is interesting. Go back a little bit, talking about the space that you're working on now for a tech company where, you know, they're incorporating all these spaces. Are they able to bring the outdoors in? I mean, you have some constraints with the building envelope, but are they opening up spaces to get more outdoors in? Or what kinds of things are you doing along that?
Yes, to answer your question. The other thing, they're bringing the people outdoors. Mm-hmm. So they're taking over rooftops, creating new stairs. So, for instance, they're taking consecutive floors. So instead of just having it a work floor, they're opening up a 30-foot by 30-foot section down to the floor below. They're planting a 40-foot tree that comes through this opening, and then they're taking the space on the roof, and they're making it a collaborative work area, not just for the summer months, 365 days a year. They're getting their people out there. They're putting wireless access points. They're putting up the coffee machines out there. So you're taking the people. You're not bringing the indoors. You're bringing the outdoors in. You're bringing the people outside, which you see a lot of. A lot of the tech companies are doing that, even in New York City, where you could get a foot of snow every week, as you guys know, in Denver. So it's very interesting, because when you're downtown, there's so many requirements for landmarks, because the requirements are old buildings, and they have such control over making it higher or what do you see from the street. So that is a challenge. The biggest challenge I find – New York City is crazy. I have a quick story about New York City. Coming from New Jersey, where if I wanted to close a sidewalk for a half a day, I had to get an engineer drawing. I had to get the city engineer to buy into it. I had to go to city council three times. And I had to hire five cops, and I closed the road for a half hour, and I was done. In New York City, if I want to close the sidewalk, I put two guys who I don't even know, stop the pedestrians, load it up to the roof. All right, go ahead. Like, it was never there.
You think it would be the opposite.
You think it's the opposite.
Yeah.
There's so many rules. There's no rules. And coming again, the one thing is crazy. So let's talk about plumbing. My first job, I get to go down, and he goes, all right, you got to meet the plumber. We have an inspection at 10 o'clock. Okay. So I go down there with the drawings, and they're all signed and sealed. I'm waiting for the plumbing inspector from the city of New York. And 10:20, plumber goes, all right, let's go. Time to go. We passed. I go, what do you mean we passed? He goes, yeah, he didn't come. We passed. He's a 20-minute window. If he doesn't come within 20 minutes, we pass. We're done. Let's go. And I couldn't believe it. My jaw dropped. I said, it can't be this way. I went back and asked all the PMs in my office. The plumber, is he just trying to get one over on me? We waited 20 minutes. The plumber inspector didn't come. He said, we passed. Yeah, you passed. We get over it. You're done. Job's done. I couldn't believe it. In New Jersey, you would wait 4 hours for that plumbing inspector to show up.
And you couldn't do anything until
you couldn't
done,
do anything. Yeah. And you sat there and you waited. That was it. But it's amazing. It is amazing what goes on. I don't know if Denver has it, but New York is built on expediters. If you want to build a job, you no longer go down to City Hall and you sign your name to the permit and you say, here you go, Mr. Clerk. You hire an expediter and they do all the paperwork for you, for a fee, of course. And they do everything from the plumbing, the sprinkler, the electrical, the fire alarm. They handle everything. So all you have to do is really just send them the drawings.
And they can fast track because everyone knows
correct.
They're scratching each other's back.
Well, not even scratching his back. They're talking about like qualified people. They're taking – the city is saying, XYZ expediter, I trust the fact that you've read these and you know what we want and I trust you and it better be done right.
Yeah, and I'm going to hold you responsible
correct.
If it's not.
Yeah, and they do. Because so many times you go back and you got to fix it because an I wasn't dotted or a T wasn't crossed. So
that's interesting. So is that pretty much standard for you guys
standard.
On the expediters?
Standard. Florida's the same way, by the way. I couldn't believe it. I wanted to open that business in New Jersey. If you want to get into just making money for nothing, open an expediting company in Denver, Colorado, and just manage everybody's permit process. I swear.
The permit process here is a mess because it's always – everyone, you know, when they decide they want to go, they want to go now.
Yep.
And then you go into the permit. And last year, that was one of the biggest hiccups. It could be 3 months into permitting and you're just sitting there waiting.
But like I said, the city counts on the fact that an expediter has put everything into place. They filled out all the proper forms. And instead of 3 months, it's 2 weeks. Seriously, you guys want to be millionaires? Never. Open that company.
Well, I experienced
maybe it's already
that.
Happening. I don't know. Well,
yeah,
if any listeners know about expediting, we want to hear from you.
Yeah, I haven't heard too much about that here. I'm real familiar with it. When I was a builder in Nevada, when Las Vegas was booming, most of the business in the permitting area was done with expediters. And in many cases on projects, we had expediters that were in Arizona and other places that they worked with. But it's all about that familiarity and getting to the finish line quicker because everybody's in a hurry.
Yep.
But if they're not set up to do it that way, the municipalities dictate how that's going to work. If they don't want to do it, you got to do it the old school way.
Yeah.
So. But it makes sense on both sides as well.
Yeah.
If you have a random person that doesn't know what they're doing coming in every time, you're going to have a lot more problems.
Correct.
that person has to educate them.
Yep.
Versus a guy that's coming in that knows what he's doing. I mean, every time we do a new project, it takes twice as long
yep.
because you you're figuring it out.
Yeah, and it's amazing. What we ran into is you would have, when you didn't use that process, you'd have builders and architects that would go in and they would get kicked out, whereas the expediters, what they do is they look at the set of plans. They know where the problems are. They get with the builder and the architect up front. They get the problems fixed. When they go in, it's a lot quicker.
It's worth the
Typically,
money, yeah. To your point.
Oh, absolutely.
Like you say, time is money. Yep. If you're not building for 3 months, that $150, whatever it was,
lifesaver. Yeah, it's peanuts.
Yeah. Every show we talk about it, get it right on paper and pay to get it right on paper, because just going for it and living on a hope and a prayer is tough.
Yep. Now you pay for it in the end. You really do.
Absolutely. Well, you talked earlier about working on some of the landmark buildings. I mean, what are some of the most interesting buildings you've worked on, whether they're new or old, and from that standpoint?
Well, as a former history major, you go in and you see these old buildings. For instance, we're in a Daniel Burnham building. For anybody, it's a famous architect who did the Flatiron building, who's famous, did a less famous building downtown, which I'm working in. And he built these decorative terracotta columns, and they're gorgeous. And it kills you to take them down. You got to find that architect and that client that kind of sees that vision and be like, no, I just want white box around this column. It's such a struggle because you want to preserve, you're not required to by any means, but you want to preserve the history of how that building was built, because at one point it was something totally different. It was a department store, and before that it sold groceries, and it kind of grew through the centuries. And well, now it's a commercial office space, and you hope to maintain those aspects of the building. Typically, I mean, the new stuff, you're in World Trade Center, they're pretty curtain wall with some beams in the middle, elevator bank, and bathrooms. And not really, there's nothing sexy about it. The new construction is great because there's no hidden, crazy, unforeseen circumstances. You're going to open a wall and find something like, oh, man, they left the spaceship in the wall. Now I got to get a spaceship extractor to remove this, and you're paying $1 million to remove this thing that nobody knows what it is. But the ground up, the new buildings, that is the luxury. You save time. You save money. The client's happy. There's no hidden secrets.
And I would imagine on the newer buildings, you don't really have issues with access getting materials up. I mean, those I would presume are pretty well planned into the structure.
The old days, you talk about the challenges. A lot of these old buildings have an elevator. It's like a 4x4 elevator. We talked about loading anything.
Yeah.
Getting four guys in the elevator is a challenge. There's sometimes we'd take the stairs and try to get a union tradesman to walk more than a flight of stairs is like pulling blood from a rock. They just, they'd rather wait the hour down in the loading dock instead of walking up a flight of stairs. Not kidding you. But so the newer buildings, they all think, all right, I'm going to have a bank of four freights. The loading docks are massive. You go down underneath these buildings and it is a city in its own. It's a city, and it's so fascinating watching 10 tractor trailers back into this place. It's between 6 and 8 in the morning. And then it is amazing to watch. If you don't follow the rules and having your stuff on the dock at a certain time, you miss your window. And it's really hard to tell your client, I planned really poorly. I lost a day. They don't care. They don't want to hear that. We get paid to plan it properly and communicate that properly and get it done. But the newer buildings, to your point, you have a little more flexibility with these newer, like I said, they're putting this all in place where you have these massive areas where you can just load in truck after truck after truck without bothering the people who are going to work there every day.
How do you stage product? I mean, if you're in a smaller space, like you described, I mean, maybe in the case of the Rockstar, you're talking about that small area.
Yeah, that was awful.
But if you're in a high rise with a small space, how do you stage materials to be able to do the job and not miss your...
Well, that's, that we talk about like a good super makes a good PM and it trickles up. Good supers, because I don't know every detail about the job, but the super, that's his job. And it's his job to get carpet on site when he needs it, not just get it to me when it's available. A lot of times in New York, you'll pay to have it stored off-site somewhere, which is fine. You know it's sitting there, though, which is the great luxury of having. So to your point, a lot of times it sits in a warehouse in Jersey or in Brooklyn or Queens, knowing it's in the warehouse, and paying $1,000 to have it sit there for a month, no problem, but I know it's there. And I can get it when I pick up the call. I want it on Monday. All right, here it comes.
Yeah, particularly when you're sourcing something from overseas, you were talking about in that case of the glazer, that didn't show up, unfortunately, but you're getting glass from England or something. I mean, you want to get it there and have a place to put it, I would presume.
You do, especially with like tile. We talk about stone and tile. Mm-hmm. A lot of this is coming from overseas. And the kicker is a lot of times it comes on a ship. And you're like, well, it's shipping on Friday. Well, how's it shipping? Well, it's coming on a boat from England. Okay, and then it's going to sit in customs for 2 weeks. And then you're sending your guy down in a box truck down in North Carolina to go get stone to be done in a week. It's actually fascinating, for a box of tile you're missing. But it is a challenge.
So in these old buildings, what's the coolest thing you've pulled out of one?
Actually, it's not one I pulled out. Doing a townhouse. It's funny. I found a job in Midtown. It was built in 1950. They demoed the whole floor. So when we got there, it was great. They demoed the entire floor. We came to a blank space. We didn't have to do anything. And I go, and I'm, as a history guy, I go around, I knock on a wall, and the whole wall opens up. And in this wall unfolds an entire time capsule of stuff that the tradesmen from May 5th, 1951, because I know that was when they left, they marked it all, came out of the wall. Anything from beer cans, Rheingold beer cans, old homemade wine bottles, Coca-Cola bottles, their old lunch pails. They all signed their names. That was the day they finished the job. It was May 5th, 1951, and they all signed their names. They wrapped them in all newspapers. It was all Italian-American newspapers. And I went. I said, listen, I went to the building. I said, I'm going to keep one Rheingold can because I love this cool stuff. He goes, well, what else is up there? They ended up pulling out like two cases of Rheingold cans and homemade wine and the newspapers and all these books and you know, Macy's and Abercrombie outdoor books that you can buy bathtubs from. And the owner of the building was an Italian guy, and you would have thought it was the greatest thing he ever saw. And he was so thankful. I said, I don't want any of this. It's your building. It's your stuff. Keep it. And that was 2 weeks ago we pulled it out. But you just never know what tradesmen, they just shoved in the holes in the walls. And we find old newspapers. I find what's cool when we do these buildings and we tear down a wall and I find the old bricks. And the old bricks were, they used to label where they came from, which firehouse they came from. And they're all labeled and you kind of look them up and you could date the building on when those bricks were laid. It's pretty neat.
Yeah. As a guy going to school for history, teacher, that's like a cool kind of way you can – keep that passion of what, you know, obviously you wanted to do that going to school. That's neat.
I found out one time we were supposed to demo a wall and make it a pass-through for the architect. And I found it was an old townhouse built in the 1880s. And I opened the wall and I found the original. It was an 8x8 window. It was the former exterior of the building. You saw the brick and you saw the lintel and you saw the old sill still there. It's massive sill. And she goes, well, when are you going to demo that? I said, I'm not. She goes, well, it's supposed to be all white. I said, I'm not demoing that. I said, well, what do you mean? I said, I want you to bring your client down here. I want to show him this. I said, there's no way we demo this. This is a great, great feature to have on your floor. You know, you could touch base with how you feel what the building came from. And she's like, they'll never go for it. They'll never go for it. 2 hours go by. The client came down. I get a call. Yeah, they're going to keep the wall. You were right. So it was an interesting. It was a win on our side. And I said, Lee, you get to save a few bucks. You know, you don't have to pay for a you know, a trimmed opening. So, you know, but it is interesting. Like I said, these fun things, what makes it interesting in New York is every 6 months you're doing something different. There's always a challenge. There's always something different. It's always a different personality that you're managing, which is really what we do.
Yeah, and I would say that's anywhere. I mean, New York, you have a lot of fast moving place, but I would say that's anywhere.
Yeah.
So the last thing I want to do is, this is a learning organization, and kind of recap and say if there's one thing, if a contractor or architect listening to this, for both, if they want to become a project manager or them, how to work better, kind of in closing, talk about the most useful things you could leave behind for everybody.
Other than don't make shit up?
That was a good one, really.
Yeah. So that's it. All right. See you later.
I'm out. I think the most useful thing is really – don't go in with a closed mind. You got to take into account with the direction that the client, ultimately, the person who's going to live and be there and go to work there every single day, you have to take that into account. You can't just put your foot down and say, this is how I do it. This is how it's done. Let them give them the opportunity. And then if it doesn't work, you just got to manage what they're getting at the end of the day. I really believe that. And not just being, you know, a bull in the china closet. We talk about that. You know, not just your way, the highway. Those days are gone. And we talked about the old days just yelling and screaming at people, get it done. I think finding your management style is really the most important thing. You know, how do you want to get it done? Other than that, don't make shit up. And don't hide anything. You know, like I said, that's most I can give you.
Well, it's like sports, right? I mean, now when you think about it, the coaches in every sport that are really successful are the ones that are finding a way to get it out of these younger and younger athletes that are making more and more money. The old school way of yelling and screaming, like the days when Dick Butkus or somebody like that played football, it ain't happening anymore. Those guys, it just doesn't work that way anymore.
They're dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Being a smaller company, we don't have that luxury because we don't have the power behind us like those big guys do.
Right.
So it is important being able to work with everybody in that regard. And like I said, getting the most out of, you know, you do have young supers. You got to put them in a position to succeed. Because if you're not giving them the tools and the ability and the resources to make your company look good, well, what good are you doing it?
It motivates them to want to continue doing that for the next job and do better going forward because, you know, just human nature, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thanks for coming in and telling us your story in Studio MVWD. What do you say we go celebrate and go to Bruce, huh?
I like it.
All right. Fun stories, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just amazing to hear some of the coordination with not only the big clients, juxtaposition of brand new skyscrapers and dealing with buildings that are hundreds of years old and how to figure out how to build all those interiors, keep everybody happy, on time, on budget, that kind of thing. Pretty interesting.
But when every project he talked about, and you know, he worked in Florida and New York and all these different places, it's all about communication and people and getting it right on paper. It doesn't matter who we have in the studio, MVWD, we got to always listen and understand. That's the key to a successful project.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's also amazing to think of all the things that come into play when you're dealing with difficulty of getting product in and high rises and that kind of thing, and people that have certain expectations, whether it be the building owners, and then you've got all the subs to concentrate on. And really, like you talk about, the common denominator is figuring out what the mission is and finding out how to get everybody motivated and on the same page of things done timely and getting them done successfully. It really is about communication and organization.
Yeah, and so hopefully from this show, we're in the trenches in the New Yorks and all the people out there hearing about the Art of Construction, constantly growing this thing. See theartofconstruction.net for all the details and show notes and stuff that Connor's going to share with us that he can. They do a lot of stuff with companies that's more private as far as what they can share, but we'll peel as much as we can out of Connor and L&K.
And absolutely, we'll have comments on the show notes page. We'll have links to their website, but you'll notice on there too, as you go through their portfolio, you'll see a lot of projects where it'll say anonymous company or anonymous museum or whatever it may be. And you know, they have to respect the wishes of their clients, and that's why they get repeat business from these people, because a lot of people want to be anonymous. So it's at that level of project design and structure, they have to be careful. So,
and I commend Connor. I mean, he's just such a good dude, that his passion and his caring guy, that's what shows and why he's been successful wherever he's been in the construction industry. But also kind of when he needs to bring out the roughness, you know, and properly getting it done, because anybody can be a bully, but that only gets you so far. So it's managing all those expectations. And I really appreciate him coming in and telling us the stories and talking through what he does. And hopefully a project manager listens to this and gets something good out of it.
And if you didn't hear anything else, don't make shit up.
Thanks, everyone.
You have been listening to The Art of Construction, specifically designed for contractors and architects to help grow your business. To listen to more, please go to www.mtnview.us and click on the podcast tab. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, and thanks for listening.